Amen. Okay, last time, and I'm not, it may have been 2 weeks before with regard to Brother Craig. I can't remember. It seemed like I've taught once since. In chapter 2 and verse 1, we talked about the importance of sound doctrine, that is necessary in order to please God, and it helps us as well as it equips us in that life that we live for the Master. So when we talk about sound doctrine, the word doctrine means teaching, and the idea of soundness indicates that which is good or appropriate. In fact, there are a number of times in these characteristics where that concept of soundness, sound speech, for example, with regard to the young men in verse 8 of the text, that concept of soundness is one that's going to be referred to a number of times. When you talk about being sound in body, that means there's no corruption that is found there. Everything is working properly. And that concept of soundness is actually what we find in this idea of sound doctrine. That which is proper, that which is correct, that there's no corruption to be found in that doctrine. And that corruption would be, of course, that which is false, that which dilutes, that which poisons in its presence. And so this is just another one of those passages where the word doctrine means teaching, that indicates that what we teach is important, that God expects us to hew to His particular will for us. Rather than seeking to establish our own righteousness, we establish the righteousness of God. So when we look at these various groups in the church, this instruction, which is sound, is something that should be present. We won't state these as being qualifications, as we do with the office of elder that we've talked about. But when individuals are lacking in this, it is something that does not please God. This is something that is within the capability of every individual in their particular class or group and should be present. If it is not present, then something is lacking. It reminds me of what the Hebrew writer talked about in Hebrews chapter 5 when they were in need of being taught again the rudiments of the gospel of Christ. They were in need of milk rather than solid food because they were not mature, having their senses exercised to discern good and evil. Now, that's a slightly different application of the concept, but it indicates that there must be diligence in applying yourself to growing and maturing spiritually. And these are specific needs that are present with each age group and each gender. So let's start off with looking at verse 2 of the text, the older men. And the statement there that the older men are to be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, and in patience. So you'll notice there the word sound again is used in the latter part of that. And though it's used once, it has reference to the last three. We're to be sound in faith, sound in love, and sound in patience. And so we'll talk about that a little bit as we get into this discussion. Let's start off with the concept of sobriety. Anybody want to share with me their view of what the idea of the word sober, what is inclusive in that concept of being sober? Too early in the morning? Too long a week?
Clear-minded.
Okay.
Not influenced by any. You know, like when we talk about alcohol, being sober is not being, you know, influenced by alcohol. So clear-minded, not being influenced.
Okay. Very good. In fact, you're right about that. The idea of wine and intoxicants are typically used in conjunction with this word. So we could make a specific application. An individual who is sober-minded is not under the influence of an intoxicant. And that's why we talk about a person who is sober, using the term as we use it today. It's a very similar usage. But it can be involving other things than that. Someone can become caught up and influenced in ways that may have nothing to do with physical or chemical intoxicants. It may just be with regard to the influence of friends or the excitement of the moment, those kinds of things where a person is caught up and not acting as he should. He's not in control of himself.
Well,
yes? Go ahead.
Clear-headed, but as sober as a judge, and I like that because you're really alert, paying attention to everything.
Okay. All right.
So I was thinking good judgment.
Okay.
Mature.
Good deal. Good deal. So another word that is used for that is one who is temperate. In fact, maybe, don't remember, one of the translations translates it temperate, but that's the actual definition of that Greek term. So the concept again of controlling oneself, of controlling one's mind, of being an individual who is temperate, one who averts intoxicants and averts situations where you'd be out of control. That's the idea that's found there. Okay, anybody else? Second one in this text is reverent. It's from the word simnos in the Greek. The King James Version translates the word reverent as grave. So that's kind of an old word, which is why the King James uses it, of course. But what is meant by the idea of reverence, or being reverent in our actions?
It's an idea of seriousness.
Okay.
Recognizing the importance of the situation and what's going on.
And this is a general characteristic that should be present in older men always. So you think about, have you ever heard the phrase, old fool? He's just no fool. And when you hear that word old fool, or that phrase old fool, that's generally more critical of someone who is acting foolishly in general, because he's someone that ought to know better. And so this, in part, I want you to think of it in the way someone would look at you. In other words, the view that individuals have, the perception that individuals have of you when they see you. When you look at the definition as Thayer gives it, it is one who is august, one who is venerable, one who is reverent. The word reverent, I don't like. We had Ken Thayer and other denominationalists will use that term sometimes. And it's just, it's bothersome to me, because only God is reverent. At least only God is referred to in that sense in Scripture. But it does indicate this idea of a demeanor that is very respected and respectable, because the individual puts himself in a situation where he is appropriate in his actions always. The idea of foolishness and flightiness, those are things that are characteristic of young people, but as you grow older, maturity takes place and a person is less that way. It's kind of like we hear about, you know, he needs to grow up. If you say that a, you know, a 70-year-old man needs to grow up, well, that's kind of a sad situation. So that's the concept of reverence that is found in that. One who has a grave demeanor or an august demeanor, where just looking at him, the way he acts, the way he conducts himself, he is extremely respectable. That's the idea that is found in that term. Now, of course, in order for that to be possible, and this may be what some would think in this regard, is reverent would have reference to our demeanor as we approach God. That, for example, as we come to worship, we understand the seriousness of this, and that would certainly be inclusive of it, but it's something that's a little bit more general in term than just referencing our relationship to God or our approach to God. It's something that should be present in the lives of an older person. I just still haven't figured out what old means in these particular passages, because some people would say it applies to me, and I still think of myself as a younger man, but that's just me. Okay, anybody else with regard to reverence?
So, it's also speaking to the fact that you should be viewed as someone that has obtained this. Does that make sense? Like, you should be... you should be respected. I'm not looking at anything up there.
No, I know. I am, though. I wanted to look at something.
You should be respected. It's kind of like that old fool thing you were talking about there. You should be somebody that people look at and go, hey, there's somebody who has the wisdom and the character and the leadership and example that should be expected of somebody that's come to that age. And so it's not just how you look approach it, but it's how you were viewed
by it. Right. Yeah. And you know, when I was doing it, the reason I looked up there is because I was looking at the picture that I put up to, you know, on these practical matters, I always try to supply a picture that's somewhat representative. It's kind of difficult to do, to find older men and not, you know, just find the circumstance. So I don't know where this is or what's happening, but the way they're dressed and the man's hand on the shoulder and the seriousness of the conversation as it is perceived to be, that's a perception. Those two guys may be old fools, both of them. And so just looking at that, you might think, well, you know, maybe the only time they've ever worn a suit and a hat is at a funeral, and that's a funeral. Who knows? But that's the perception. So that's a surface perception. Perhaps you've seen individuals like this, that there's something about the way they look that shows gravity. People will look at that and say, well, that person would seem to be a reverent person or an august individual. But they open their mouths, but they act in a particular way, and what seems to be is instantly dispelled. And we need to recognize that in all these things that what matters is not necessarily external, but rather the character, the demeanor, the actions of an individual, the speech of an individual. And that's why what Justin said is so very true, because if an individual is like this, does act this way, then people are going to perceive him and see him in that way. So it does have much to do with the concept of reputation. When Paul told Timothy, let no one despise your youth, that idea of despising youth, how do you keep that from happening? And we talked about that a while back. You'll remember that you can't help what people think about you. If they are ungodly or unjust, they're going to think inappropriate things about you, whether it's justified or not. But you're to act in such a way as to where you give them no reason to despise your youth, and that's the idea. So this concept of reverence, these two men, somebody, you know, 20 yards away from them, just glancing at them, may consider them to be august and dignified and all the things that we've talked about. But what's important is the individuals who know them. Are they that way? People who know us and interact with us, are we considered by them as being reverent in our demeanor? Okay. All right, so third one is the idea of temperate. We've talked about temperance quite often. The idea of temperance, and it ties in with the idea of sobriety, by the way. These are very similar terms. The Greek word sophron. And it means of a sound mind, to be sane in one's senses. But the idea is you're in control of yourself. So you have your senses about you. And one of the things that comes to my mind with regard to training is important in order to be able to control yourself. I read an article just recently about how much training that, for example, police officers will do with their handgun in order to prepare themselves for a difficult situation where their life is on the line, and how do you act and how do you conduct yourself, only to get in that particular situation, all the training goes out the window, and typically those shootouts end up spraying bullets everywhere and seldom pointing in the direction you want them to point. And that's understandable in to an extent, because your life's on the line and it's a scary thing and all, but it's one of those things where you train to be in control, and then the first time the shooting happens, you lose all control. And so a couple of things to note in regard to that, because that's an extreme example, is that in order for us to be sane, in control of one's senses, or in the secondary definition, which I think is very applicable here, to curb one's desires and impulses, to be self-controlled, that takes training on our part. And the good thing about this is as you grow older, those circumstances arise time and time and time again where you can get better at it. I would think that a police officer who may go his entire career without drawing his gun and shooting, or if he does in that final instance, that's his first time, if you get a battle-hardened soldier who has not only done the training, but has actually been in battle, then he's going to be more in control because he's gone through it already, and he's reacted to it, and he's learned from his mistakes, and it's not new to him. And when we talk about the idea of temperance, that's an idea of control. And it's something that should be the purview of a mature individual, someone who has lived as a Christian for a long while, for that individual to be unable to control himself, to not be in control of his senses or of his actions. That would be something that would be disturbing. That should be something characteristic of an older man. All right. Comments about temperance. Next one is the word sound. Now, we made reference to that, already gave a short definition. It comes from a Greek word, and it's found a number of times in these texts. And this will be applied to the idea of faith, love, and patience. The word sound means to be in good health. So the idea of a person's body, that it is a sound body, means there's nothing that is particularly wrong with it. But when it's used metaphorically, as it is in this particular case, it has reference to Christians whose opinions are free from any mixture of error. That's the definition from Thayer. So when we talk about faith and love, we'll enlarge upon that concept. But I want you to think in mind that in these three things, faith, love, and patience, there are directives that are given by God as to how to be faith, sound in faith, how to be sound in love, how to be sound in patience. In other words, God has directed us in the ways in which we should act to exhibit these particular things, to where our actions are free from any mixture of error. So when we talk about, I'll just give you a quick example of this with regard to the concept of discipline. God has given us instructions, 1 Corinthians 5, Matthew 18, other places, that show us how we're to conduct ourselves when an individual is overtaken in a fault, whether it be a fault that is between him and I, or a fault that is before the congregation, and there are actions that we're to take in an expression of our love for that person. Someone comes along, as the Corinthians did in 1 Corinthians 5, and says, no, we're not going to do that. Why? Well, because we love him too much. I've actually heard that expression given. I'm too concerned about his soul. I don't want to reject him. If we practice this discipline, it might be something that will drive him away. So we're going to do what we think to be right rather than doing what God says is the right thing to do. And so while we may be, in our own estimation, practicing love, where we, the denominations think that they are sound in faith when what they're practicing is not in accord with God's word. And we could do the same thing with regard to patience, where the exhibition of our patience, we'll talk about what that is in a moment, may be perceived by us to be as it should be because error has been mixed in, because the concepts that we hold are not accurate. Then we are not sound in these things. So that's the idea. So if your soundness, you know, let's say a body with regard to cancer is sound, it's because there's no cancer present. And it's not in the body. A person who is sound in faith is an individual who has not added any mixture of error, which would make his faith unsound or corrupt it. And that's the concept of soundness there. So when we talk about faith, there are a number of things to keep in mind. The word faith, I want you to go down to verse 10 of the text very quickly, talking about the bondservants. You'll notice there it says, not pilfering, but showing all good fidelity. All good fidelity. Another word that is used there is faithfulness. It's actually the exact same word that we're looking at here in the second verse. So the word pistis, the Greek word pistis, is a very common word that is used for a number of different reasons. It can have reference, for example, to one's personal faith, what I believe, my convictions, and those, of course, may be true or false. They may be based on error, based on truth. It has reference to the faith, having reference to what God has revealed. Jude 3, contend for the faith once for all delivered to the saints, for example. You can go back in our own text, Titus chapter 1 and verse 4, where he says he's writing to Titus, a true son in our common faith. So it would have reference to the faith rather than my personal faith. So I can have personally faith in faith, having reference to a faith in what God has revealed to be the faith. Third way which is used is found there in chapter 2 and verse 10, which means that I am to be faithful. And that could have reference to faithful to God's word, faithful to my brethren, faithful to my master as a bondservant. That's the idea of fidelity or faithfulness. It's all the same word, so context determines how that's going to be used. In this particular context, what way is it have, does it have reference to be sound in faith, do you believe? There's probably two possibilities. You want to hazard a guess? Do what? I think so. I think that's probably what's under consideration. For me to be sound in faith, personally, with regard to my personal faith, it's necessary that I be sound in the faith. And so, regardless of whichever you would say is indicated there, it gets back to the concept that I cannot be sound unless I am holding to my conviction rest upon what God has revealed. So that's the first point. Okay? What about sound in love? What's indicated by that? It's the Greek word agape. We all know what that means. So what does it mean to be sound in love?
I think that can cover a wide range of things. That agape love, that's brothers, that can include the love of your God, the love of your brethren, love of your family.
And when you key in this concept of
all that, and it, like you just said with faith, it goes back to what God's definition of, for example, being sound in love, well, sometimes, there's that tough love. We talk about church discipline, for example, and our responsibility towards a brother or sister that's withdrawn from, if we're not practicing as we should, we can't say that we are sound in love, because in that situation, our mothership calls us to offer them as we are commanded to, so that they might be ashamed and restored to both adults. So it's a wide range of applications you can make to that.
Well, certainly, because when we are to practice agape love, it is to every single individual, even our enemies. So, yeah, it's just
there. Two high-level ways in which your love cannot be sound, and maybe not whole and healthy. One is that it's not a proper manifestation of love, so you go to compassion over tough love, and compassion is actually the wrong thing to do, like Josh was talking about. But the other one is when your behavior is actually fine, but it's not soundly rooted in love. So, love God, you'll keep His commandments, but you can keep His commandments but not rooted out of love. You can do nice things for people because you don't want the repercussions of what people will do or think of you or whatever if you don't. Or you can do nice things or loving things because you want to be seen of men. It has to do with both sides of the equation, both the action and the heart behind that.
That's very good. Yeah, because when we think about it, concept of love as agape love as it pertains to the Christian's life is all-encompassing. Anytime we interact with other individuals, no matter what the circumstances, our motivation should always be what's best for them in that interaction. And if that's not the motivation, even if there are actions that are not necessarily destructive or harmful at all, anything, but if our motivation is not what it's supposed to be, then that's a lack of soundness. So that's a very good point to make. Yeah, that's the basic idea, is we need to, and by the way, how this applies to older men, should have reached the point through experience to know how best to express themselves in love in a particular situation or circumstance. That's one of the things to keep in mind. They have their senses exercised to discern good and evil, mature Christian. And so there may be young people that may have an understanding of the principles of doing what's best for your neighbor and have an understanding of God's word with regard to that. And yet a scenario arises to where it's difficult to know how best to express that love in that situation or circumstance. So they may do it improperly or cause some harm rather than good, though their intent may be to cause good. But an older man needs to have that ability to read the room, to understand what the situation and circumstance is, and through experience and proper application, through maturity, be able to properly express his love for others. And that's why these kinds of things, though there are overlaps, and these are things we should all aspire to, whether young or old, he's saying, especially older men, you talk about men who serve as elders, you talk about men who are good examples that people look up to. If you make mistakes in this area, it can be extremely damaging, destructive. So it's important to be sound in love. And then finally, in patience. The word that is translated patience in the Greek means steadfastness, constancy, and endurance. I want to keep in mind that concept of endurance that is found there. And, you know, once again, experience has a part to play in this. And older individuals have been through more. Older men have been through more than younger men, for example. Doesn't mean that they grow patient. But I'll tell you one thing that has happened with me as I have grown older, and this especially applies to the experiences that I've had as a gospel preacher. I see sometimes the fervor of younger men who are serving and see their reactions to circumstances and situations. And I understand why they do what they do, because I did that way myself, but now I would do it differently. And not saying don't do anything dealing with circumstances, situations, but I would just handle it differently than I did as a young man, because I've learned some things as time has gone on. And that idea of being patient, of being enduring, of being constant in your actions is something that's extremely important as well. Give you an example, Job chapter 1, 21 and 22, where Job, at the end of this cycle of persecution that he suffered at the hand of the devil, of course, and ultimately with God's permission, he said in verse 21, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. And he truly was an individual who was sound in his patience and would serve as a good example for us. All right, questions, comments about what we looked at with the responsibilities of older men? All right, then we go to the next one, the responsibilities of older women. And again, apologize for the stereotypical nature of the picture. I don't want to offend anyone in that regard, because that's very older women here, and it's certainly not applicable only to those who are that age. It's an interesting thing that when you talk about the word elder and having reference to the office, and again, context is important in all of these things. We talk about the office of an elder. If anyone desires to be an elder, the word is presbyteros. And that term is one that we are familiar with. Well, when you look at the older man, it's presbytes, which it has that same root. Here in this text, in chapter 2, verse 2, he's obviously not talking about elders as an office, but rather elders having reference to men who are older. And the same thing is true with regard to this term, an older woman. It is presbytes. P-R-E-S-B-U-T-I-S and P-R-E-T-E-S. So it is the feminine form of that same word. So it simply just means that which is older. And you'll notice the statement made in verse 3, the older women likewise. So what he's basically saying is, just as you are to exhort the older men to be a particular way, you are to do the same with regard to the older women. Of course, we could go down and say the same thing is applicable to the younger women, younger men, and the bondservants. But in this, there is that call for her to be reverent in behavior. That's a slightly different word, but it is synonymous to what we saw with regard to the men being reverent. Here it has reference to reverence in behavior, having actual application to the demeanor. And so the definition of that term, as Thayer gives it, is her behavior is that which is befitting with regard to your interaction with God. In other words, it is befitting that which is sacred to God. In other words, as we talked about before with the men, it has reference to a woman conducting herself in a way that God considers holy, God considers right, God considers proper, and her reverence, her behavior should be in that way. In 1 Corinthians 3, more general, broad application, in verse 17, the Apostle Paul says that if anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, which temple you are. Your temple is holy. So your actions, how you conduct yourself, it should be something that that is holy before God or sacred before God. And that's the concept of reverence in behavior. Comments, questions about that? All right. Then the next one is not slanderers. What is a slanderer? Anybody familiar with the Greek term for devil? What's the Greek word that is translated devil in our scriptures? What's the word devil in Spanish? That's actually, I guess, taken from the Greek, but it's diabolos, or diabolos, excuse me. So it's that kind of a concept. So who is the devil? He is the accuser. And that's what a slanderer is. He's one who is accusing falsely. That's the easiest. Prone to slander, slanderous, accusing falsely, a calumniator, a false accuser, or a slanderer. I'm going to have to start using that word, calumniator. You're a calumniator. I'll have to make sure I'm pronouncing it correctly before I start using it, though. So that idea is one who accuses falsely, false accusations. What comes to mind is a particular situation, circumstance happened years ago here. And it was an older woman in that case, by the way. But some accusations had been raised, and she had basically gossiped with regard to that because she had no first-hand knowledge of the accusations. And the accusations were rescinded. In other words, the person who made the accusation said that wasn't true, it didn't happen. And she persisted in sharing those accusations despite that. She was admonished for it. And her statement was, but it's true. And she claimed that pressure is what caused the other individual to not renege on that. And in actuality, it was true. There's no way that she could have known that it was true. But she was basically just basing it on what another had said. So gossip is something that is tied in commonly with this concept of slandering. It is seldom that you slander someone to their face. Now that could happen. It happens in political debates all the time. It happens in political interviews when they say something about the other candidate or the other person and they say something that is false. We're not talking here about the legal definition of slander, where it could be proven to be defamatory and proven to be defamatory for the purpose of tearing someone down. You know, libel and slander, as those terms are used legally in our society, you very seldom hear about a court case where there is that claim of slander or libel that it actually is won, because there has to be not only that evil thing said, but also there has to be a proving of motive as to why it was said. We're talking about actually making false accusations, regardless of an individual's motive in regard to it. So what that means is that you have to be careful. For one, you need to be careful not to be one who makes accusations, typically. But there are times when it is necessary to make an accusation. When you make an accusation, you need to make sure of the fact that what you are accusing someone of is a true accusation. Because if it is false, even if you think that it's true, you're guilty of defaming someone who is innocent of what you're charging them with. And that is something that is very, really, very, very possible. Giving that example that I talked about a moment with that lady, one side of the story was heard, and that lady acted on that one side. Didn't hear both sides. Didn't take the time to investigate before sharing some information. She thought she was doing good. She thought she was doing something that was necessary and helpful, but it wasn't. And part of it was because she only heard one side. And again, it's something that every one of us have to deal with from time to time. I don't know exactly why older women are singled out in regard to this with this admonition. But I know as a preacher, it's something very important for me to know, because there are many, many times when I'll come across, whether it be in our congregation or whether I'm hearing something that someone else has to say about another congregation, it may even be something to where they're seeking counsel or seeking advice. This is happening in our church. I don't know how to deal with it. What would you say? And I have to be very, very careful, because if I just take what they have to say as the truth and tell them, well, this is what you need to do, this, 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 and this, when in reality their perception, what they're saying is actually not true, then I could be contributing to something bad being done in a congregation rather than something good. So it's important when we think about this is to recognize that even if our motive is pure, we can still be guilty of slander. And so it is important that we listen to the evidence, that we not act upon something where we can't know for a certainty that it's true. It's not saying, again, that when admonition is needed, we don't deliver that admonition. We just need to make sure that such admonitions and talking about those kinds of things is actually needful. When the Apostle John referred to Diotrephes, he had first-hand knowledge about it. I think that Diotrephes wouldn't receive him. He made reference to that. I think it wasn't a matter of, well, he hadn't received others, and I wouldn't think he would receive me either, but that he had been rejected by Diotrephes. When you had Alexander the coppersmith, the Apostle Paul said, has done me much harm. He had first-hand knowledge of what Alexander the coppersmith had been saying about it and been doing. To destroy his reputation. And so the accusation he made against Alexander the coppersmith was one that was legitimate and true. He didn't slander him. So it's important that we have that knowledge, that proof, before we make even needed accusations. But slander typically is involved with gossip. Did you hear about so-and-so? This is what they did. And you may not have that knowledge of it. Secondly, motivation often is bad with regard to slander, that you're demeaning someone purposefully because either it elevates you in comparison or because you have a hateful nature. And older women need to be careful not to become bitter and not to engage in such activities. Okay? I kind of got on the soapbox there, didn't I? Anybody have anything they want to add to that? Okay. All right. So, third one, not giving much wine. The word is oinos. We talked a little bit about this with regard to the deacons. The same qualification is given for the deacons. The same phrase is used as is used here. The word oinos is a word which is generic in nature. Sometimes it has reference to intoxicating drinks. Sometimes it has reference to grape juice. It's simply the fruit of the grape. Context is what is extremely important in determining what this is. I noted that there are indications and evidence in contemporary writings concerning practices that were present at this time of being gluttonous with regard to imbibing grape juice, even non-intoxicating drink. In fact, it is a part of partying, because individuals didn't want to become insensible. Often what they would do is imbibe in excess with regard to food and drink, but it wasn't intoxicating drink. It was just basically gorging themselves and making themselves sick on drink. In fact, it became a contest. They would have contests. Who can drink the most oinos, the most wine? And it didn't have reference to who can hold their liquor, but rather just who can drink the amount, the copious amount, the greatest extent. And so there may be a reference there to this too, that it may be gluttony other than that. I believe, though I understand that was something that was a common practice, that there is a reference to intoxication in this context. But I did want to make note of the fact that that there were practices of gluttony involving drink that were very common in that time. Those kinds of things, whether it be intoxication or concepts of excess, should not be present in an older woman's life. We get through this particular one. I thought we were going to go a little faster, but when we do it the way we're doing it, it's not going as quickly. The next one, teachers of good things. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Greek term here. It's basically literally teachers of good. It looks like kaleidoscope, but it's not. That's why I'm not going to try to pronounce it. It's a long word. It has didaskalos in it, which is didactic, having reference to teaching. So that's where that is. The first part is kalo, having reference to good. So it's good teaching or teaching good. So a teacher of goodness. Specifically, and the question arises in this particular thing, who are you to teach and what you're to teach? Both those questions are answered in this particular thing, because in verse 3, it says they be teachers of good things, admonishing the young women. So, what's answered in this is why you're to be a teacher. You have wisdom that is beneficial, that is good. It answers who it is that you're to teach. You're to teach specifically the young women. So keep that in mind, that there is a place for older women with regard to teaching. We understand that older women are to be remain silent in the church, that the Apostle Paul suffers not a woman to teach and have authority over a man, but to be in submission. But that does not mean that teaching is not an important part of what an older woman does. She can do that through actions. Influence can be a good teacher, but also through instruction. So this tells us two things. Number one, younger women need to be accepting of that instruction. Now, we live in a very polite society, and so it's seldom that an older woman is going to come to a younger woman unsolicited. I think maybe there is some indication here some of that should be happening. If you see something that is incorrect or improper, that concept of admonition is something that you do to correct. And you say, well, it's not my place. Well, it is your place. That's exactly what the Apostle Paul is telling Titus to tell the older women. It is your place to admonish the young women. But secondly, the young women need to recognize they have a great resource that they can turn to. A great deal of practical advice to be given, of the proper application of spiritual principles. And just the fact that, just as with older men, older women are generally more grave in their demeanor and reverent in their demeanor. And as such, you can learn a great deal from them. So there needs to be, I mean, we have it somewhat systematized with regard to the teaching men do. Men stand in the congregation and they teach. They're used to teaching. They're used to being given instructions by other men. That doesn't happen nearly as often. It is more casual. More experiential. It happens day by day rather than in a class setting with regard to women. And so there may be some hesitancy on that part to either share or to request information. So if you could be more mindful of that, it would be very helpful to the younger women and make the older women feel more needed as well in this regard. But notice there to be teachers of good things. The word good is a general term. It would be in conjunction with the concept of what Scripture teaches and the proper application thereof. And then there is that word, an admonition of the young women. And that means to restore to a proper sense, to moderate, to control, to curb, to disciple or teach. And it means to hold one to their duty and to admonish or exhort earnestly. So all these are kind of concepts here. So the idea is, again, you see a particular action. That action may not be in accord with what it should be. Or it may simply be a reminder that you're doing good. But the idea is you show them what is right and what is proper, and help them to be as they should be. Now, when we get into the discussion of what it is they should be, it says to admonish them, notice in verse 4, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be blasphemed. So those are specific areas. That, of course, comes with the younger women, which is what we'll be talking about in our discussion next week. All right? Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. We'll get to the responsibilities of the younger women next time.